Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with one of my favorite people and my doctor, Dr. Paul Lemansky, a board-certified internist with a master's degree in human nutrition. The main focus of his practice is disease prevention using nutrition, exercise, and lifestyle. Dr. Lemansky has served as director of the Center for Preventive Medicine and as clinical chief for cardiovascular health at Kaiser Permanente's Northeast Division. He's an assistant clinical professor of medicine at Albany Medical College and is a fellow of the American College of Physicians. A graduate of New York Medical College, Dr. Lemansky has recently announced the opening of his new office at 2 Executive Park Drive in Albany for the practice of internal medicine and lifestyle medicine. We'll talk about all of this and much more, but first, welcome my friend, my doctor, Paul Lemansky.
Thank you, Alan. I'm happy to be here.
Paul, recently you came on for a Vox Pop, which we did, and I thought it deserved a more intense conversation. Now, I am a borderline diabetic. I don't mind talking about that. I have numbers which are somewhat disturbing, and you introduced into my life the work of Dr. Jason Fung, who has an interesting theory, one which apparently has been around for a while. Maybe you could start us out.
Yeah, I mean, the idea which Dr. Fung, and of course, I don't agree with everything that he says, but I think the great majority of things that he espouses make good sense to me on the basis of my own experience. I have been working in the area of diabetes prevention and improvement over the last 15 years, and I was able to focus on what I felt was an approach that empirically worked very well. And that approach was using a low-carbohydrate diet to treat pre-diabetics and individuals with diabetes. The reason for that had to do with some commonsensical thinking that by depleting the body of sugar, and that includes stored sugar and glycogen in the liver, that one would be able to lower blood sugars. And indeed, in the 15 years that I've been doing this kind of an approach in individuals with prediabetes and diabetes, I've seen rather dramatic reductions in blood sugar within a very short period of time. We're talking 3 to 5 days. I have had, of necessity, to reduce insulin in individuals who had diabetes. And again, this should always be done. These kind of dietary manipulations in people with diabetes on medications should always be done with a very closely supervising physician. But I've had, on average, to have insulin requirements for folks who come in with diabetes and cut their insulin in half in order to not bottom them out. Okay, and I have them finger sticking 4 times a day. And they have my cell phone number to call me with any blood sugar below 100 or greater than 200. And I've many times had individuals call me with higher blood sugars rather than lower blood sugars, but that's okay. You know, it's much safer to be running a little high than it is to be running a little low, certainly when you're experimenting with this kind of an approach. So I have some experience with using low-carbohydrate diets. The thing that Dr. Fung had suggested, which I found to be very intriguing, is that, now he is a nephrologist, I'm an internist, he has focused on the use of not only low-carbohydrate diet, but also intermittent fasting to resensitize people to the effects of their own insulin. So what we mean by that is type 2 diabetes is not a situation like type 1 diabetes where you don't have enough insulin. In fact, your body is producing excessive amounts of insulin. It just doesn't work well. It doesn't work to lower blood sugar. It doesn't work to take blood sugar from the bloodstream and get it into the cells of the body. Why is that? We're not really quite sure, but there are receptors on the surface of cells that accept the insulin molecule, and those receptors will turn on a pump that takes sugar from the bloodstream and pumps it into the cell. And what we know is that for some reason, insulin resistance develops in people with type 2 diabetes. And that insulin resistance prevents that insulin from really working adequately. And we have historically been attempting to focus in people with prediabetes and diabetes to focus on blood sugar instead of focusing on insulin resistance. And I think that's where Dr. Fung has made some significant headway. And I don't think it's just Dr. Fung. Actually, if you look at the American Diabetes Association in their guidelines from 2018, they have recommended for individual patients who have sufficient support and are willing to do this, a ketogenic diet, which is this low carbohydrate diet, for the treatment of diabetes. So this has gotten mainstream. There are a number of physicians across the country who have been utilizing low carbohydrate diets to try to achieve what we call remission of diabetes. That's not truly cure of diabetes, and we could talk about what cure would be, but remission means, and is defined as basically a complete remission would be 1 year of normal blood sugar without any medication. And a prolonged remission would be 5 years. We see prolonged remission and complete remissions most commonly in individuals who have had bariatric surgery, who had diabetes going into it. And the interesting aspect of this, Alan, is that when you have diabetes and have bariatric surgery, your blood sugar corrects, that is, it goes dramatically down and you go off insulin, within days after the surgery.
Why is that?
Well, we don't know. We think it's because the surgery in some way addresses the issue of insulin sensitivity. Okay? So before any significant weight loss, we've always associated improvement in blood sugar in diabetics with weight loss. I mean, they're obese and they lose weight and their blood sugar comes down. However, in the bariatric folks where we have, you know, a surgery performed on one day, within the next week, their blood sugars dramatically come down and we feel this is before any significant weight loss has occurred, and we feel this is probably because there is a resensitizing of individuals to their own insulin.
Paul, do they stay down after they had the bariatric surgery?
Yes.
Wow, that's interesting.
And they stay down for a very long, very long time. They go into periods what we call not just a complete remission, but prolonged remission. And it does so much better than any other treatment that we are aware.
Wow.
Now, this is where, you know, and I did for a number of years was working with a bariatric surgeon. And so it became rather clear in watching these people postoperatively that they had dramatic improvements in their blood sugar within a very short period of time. And he would point out to me, look, this is happening and we don't know why it's happening, but this is happening as a function of the surgery. It's not weight loss. And he was right.
So just to follow along with you and be every man's questioner.
Sure.
When you posited before that the body was making insulin in type 2 diabetics, mm-hmm. if I've heard you correctly, but that somehow the receptors were not functioning in terms of whatever needed to be done.
That's right. Whether there's a change in the shape of the receptor, or the receptor in some way becomes less sensitive to insulin that is circulating in the bloodstream, it doesn't actuate the pump, because the receptor has to accept the insulin molecule for the pump to be activated, which takes blood sugar from the bloodstream and pumps it into the cells of the body. For some reason, in individuals who are diabetic, and also individuals who are pre-diabetic now, this is a continuum, you know, the same, however, physiological mechanisms are being used. For some reason, there is a insensitivity that forces the body to try and overcome that insensitivity, to try to overcome, get the sugar from the bloodstream back into the cells, results in producing even more insulin. So in actuality, in a type 2 diabetic, what's happening is you become not sensitive to the effects of your own insulin, and you therefore, your body responds by producing more insulin, creating what we call a hyperinsulin state. And that hyperinsulin state, for a time, can overcome the resistance, but over as time goes on, your body loses the capacity to do that. And the reason why that happens is the cells that produce the insulin, which are called islet cells, because they're little islets or islands in the pancreas, the cells that produce that are finite in number. You're born with the total number that you're going to have. You don't make extra islet cells. And you actually burn those cells out through overwork. So as an example, and this process may take the process of becoming a diabetic may take 5 or 10 years, where blood sugar rises, your body puts out more insulin in an attempt to pull that blood sugar down. It struggles more and more to be able to accomplish that, is unable to do so. And in the process, the cells that produce the insulin work at not just 100% of capacity to produce enough insulin to pull the blood sugar down, but 100, 120% of capacity, and burn themselves out. By the time a person is diagnosed as type 2 diabetes, they've lost, believe this or not, 50 to 70% of the cells that produce insulin.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
So a couple of questions, Paul Lemansky, just to sort of bring us back. Why is there seemingly this huge epidemic of type 2 diabetes in this country?
Right. Well, you know, we think if we look at what occurred in the last 20 or 30 years and why there's such an increase. And Alan, I'm going to tell you right now, today, there are 100 million people in the United States who have either diabetes or prediabetes.
So that's 1 out of 3.
Yeah, 100 million people. It's unbelievable. It's a public health disaster waiting to happen. Now, what I mean is there are 25 million people with diabetes. There are probably 75 million people with prediabetes. And the prediabetics are converting to diabetes at a rate of about 11% per year.
Wow.
So it's a dramatic process, and it's probably driven by body weight. Because Americans' body weight is also, you've got, you know, obesity now has become epidemic in the United States and in much of the developed world.
Not to bring it back to me, but I'm a pretty thin fellow, and yet I got it.
Right.
I have a twin brother who has it worse, much worse than I do. So it is interesting that this is a national epidemic, that people are getting it. So let's bring Dr. Fung back into this.
Yeah. And I think, Alan, you know, we have to make sure that the listeners understand that when we talk of type 2 diabetes, you know, we're generally talking about an adult, okay, and we're generally talking about someone who's overweight or obese, but not everybody. You just happen to be one of those few that has this problem because of genetic predisposition, and most everybody who develops diabetes is going to have a genetic predisposition. Some have it more than others, and therefore, if you have genetic predisposition plus you're overweight or obese, you know, and you're eating improperly and not exercising, doing all these, you may get it much more likely than if, in your case, for example, you have genetic predisposition, but everything else you do has been really very, very healthy.
And
exercise, eating right. And therefore, you're able to delay and or maybe even avert the development of frank diabetes.
Full level. Let's consider this for a moment. We're sometimes talking about just a couple of pounds. In other words, if somebody,
yes,
Paul, wants to lose a couple of pounds and has prediabetes or diabetes, it may make a huge difference.
Huge. And this is the message that really has to get out to the general population. In order to cause remission of diabetes, and in order to cause even just marked improvement, in order to actually, in a pre-diabetic, prevent the development of diabetes, does not require 50 pounds of weight loss, even if you're 50 pounds above your ideal body weight. So if you're 5'2" and you're 200 pounds, the diabetes prevention program suggests that if you lose 5% of your body weight, that would be 10 pounds.
Okay, so 125 pounds, or let's say...
Well, I think in your particular case, because you're not obese or overweight, those are the criteria that were used for obese and overweight people. So you don't really fall into that group. You're a different group, and we'll talk about that.
Okay.
But what Dr. Fung is getting at is utilizing, in the case of the diabetes prevention program for obese and overweight people, utilizing weight loss, a small amount of weight loss, a 200-pound person losing 10 pounds and being able to decrease conversion to frank diabetes by 57%.
Wow.
That's dramatic.
That's amazing.
And if one uses a medication like metformin, 30%. So lifestyle change, and not even that much lifestyle change has a dramatic impact on your blood sugar.
Okay, so there are people banging on their radios right now saying, okay, so what are you supposed to do?
Right. Well, you know, the first thing, you know, I think is, and we can talk how, because Dr. Fung does not just use a ketogenic diet.
Okay, stop there. Ketogenic diet.
Okay, so ketogenic diet is the low carbohydrate diet.
Right.
Okay, like an diet.
But you put your body into ketosis.
You put your body into ketosis. What is ketosis? Ketosis is you know, I like to talk about the biochemistry of starvation. Okay, so what ketosis is, Alan, is simply you don't have any food. You have water, but no food. Okay, you are basically in starvation mode, and after about 3 days, you use up all the glucose that you store in your body. So where do you have glucose in your body? You have it in your liver. You have glycogen in your liver, which is glucose and water linked together in these large linear arrays. When you break the fast in the morning, okay, you're basically repleting, okay, the glucose that's in your liver. You have a nice big bowl of oatmeal, and you replete the glucose in your liver.
Now, that's too much, right?
It could be, okay, but if you start to deplete, if you're in starvation mode now, you're not going to eat that bowl of oatmeal. If you're in starvation mode, you're going to, and you're not eating anything, you're drinking water because you have to stay hydrated, okay? But what you're going to do is you're going to deplete the glycogen in the liver. Now, the body also puts glycogen in muscle, so you're going to deplete glycogen in muscle. After about 3 or 4 days, you got no more glycogen left, no more glucose. So two things are going to happen. The first thing is that you're going to use protein, okay? And that protein can be your own body protein, or it can be protein of some animal that you eat. You're going to use protein through what I call a backdoor biochemical pathway. It's called gluconeogenesis. In other words, the new glucose formation from a totally different source of glucose. Some of the amino acids can actually be turned into glucose. And you get a slow trickle of glucose in the body. Now, that's important for a variety of reasons, but let's suffice it to say that the brain prefers to run on glucose. It runs on sugar, okay? And but if there's not enough around and you're in starvation mode, you've got to start burning other sources of energy. And those sources of energy are ketones, incompletely burnt fats. Your brain will use ketone bodies, and those are, you know, acetone, acetoacetate, alpha-ketobutyrate. You actually can smell acetone. If someone's on an Atkins diet, which is a ketogenic diet, you can smell a fruity smell on their breath. That's actually acetone that they're producing coming off in their breath, okay? And you can actually measure also, we use things called keto diasticks to measure the amount of ketones produced in your urine. I will tell you that a patient comes in the morning, they're fasting, they have their blood drawn, and we get a urine sample. This is just a routine visit, and I can see ketones in the urine just after an overnight fast.
Okay. Wow.
Okay. So now, this gets back to Dr. Fong, all right? And that is, what he's focused on is that fasting for periods of time is something inherent in the biochemical heritage that we have. Human beings didn't always eat 3 squares a day. Okay? You're walking around in a loincloth with a club. You don't know where your next meal is coming from. Okay? You're going to fast for periods of time, not because you want to, but because you have to. Right? And interestingly, that creates biochemical pathways in the body that then, if we want to truly be healthy, we have to approximate those same conditions. So it's, you know, when I say it's important to eat unrefined products, why is that true? It's because 100,000 years ago, when our biochemistry was becoming adapted to our diets, okay, we were eating unrefined products. Okay, if everybody keeps eating sugar and people a lot of people die as a consequence of that, eventually, okay, we would have individuals who could process sugar. Okay, but right now, if we want to be healthy in the here and now, we have to look back at our biochemical heritage and say, how do we approximate what our ancestors were eating? We have to eat unrefined products. We have to stay away from sugar. Because sugar is a refined product. It took civilization a while to be able to produce sugar outside of honey. Okay, it took a while to be able to do that. In sufficient amounts and putting it into sufficient numbers of products that suddenly we are overloaded with sugar and developing diabetes.
It's amazing, because if I look at my refrigerator at home, there's nothing there I can eat. Other people in my family can eat it, but I can't eat
well,
it.
Well, they...
everything's got sugar in it.
Actually, they shouldn't be eating it either.
I know. I tell them that.
So what I tell my patients is I don't eat any differently. I don't tell you to eat any differently as a diabetic than I eat. I eat unrefined products as much as I can. If I'm eating pasta, I undercook the pasta to make it al dente. Why? Because then the body has to fight to get that sugar out. In the process of cooking, you are actually refining that. You're making it easier for your body to digest.
So there's some kinds of pasta that basically come because they, you know, are not the usual kind of junk.
That's correct. You can get different types of pasta made with different types of grains and whatnot, which, you know, will not supply sugar in the same amount as you would. In fact, whole wheat pasta, and again, anything that we do that approximates unrefined natural substance. That's why we talk about whole food plant-based diets. Whole food is important. Why? If you look at even, and grain, of course, is 10,000 years old. So you'll see a number of doctors going, well, we don't think that grain is good for you. They're probably right, okay, to some extent. All right. That said, if you look at grain, unrefined grain is better than refined grain. Why? If you look at wheat, if it has the germ, and it has the fiber. So the germ is fat. Fat slows absorption of carbohydrate, of sugar. Fiber slows absorption of carbohydrate, sugar. Okay?
So if you eat a steak, are you telling me that that will stop the use of sugar in your body?
Well, you know, that's a very good point. I would tell you that if you go on a very low carbohydrate diet, steak has almost zero carbohydrate in it.
Right.
Okay.
Sure.
So, but let's take an example of where you're eating a bagel in the morning, which has a huge amount of carbohydrate in it, and it's fairly highly refined because why? The flour that's used to make that bagel uses very finely ground particles that actually go into your bloodstream as sugar almost as fast as granular sugar would. So, if you're eating a bagel, if you put lox on that bagel, you've got protein, you've got fat from the lox. It'll slow the absorption of the sugar, the carbohydrate in the bagel.
What about the cream cheese?
Same thing. So in other words, if you say, I'm going to be healthy, I'll just eat this with some jam on it, bad choice.
Sure.
If you say, well, I'll eat it with some cream cheese on it, or I'll eat it with some, I mean, we're talking blood sugar now.
Sure.
Not blood cholesterol, but a blood sugar. If I'll eat it with some peanut butter. That's a much better choice and will actually slow the absorption of the carbohydrate.
Okay, that's great. Paul, I'm following you so far, and I hope everybody else out there is. We're talking to Dr. Paul Lemansky. He's talking about Dr. Jason Fung and the diabetes code and what he's been doing as a nutritionist all of these years at MD. So my question then is, if you eat the steak, though, doesn't that, you just hinted at that, doesn't that raise our LDL levels?
Yeah, it is. So in other words, this is a balancing act, okay? So you got to look, well, where's my risk coming from? Is my risk my blood sugar? Is my risk my cholesterol? I'm going to tell you that on average, there's nothing wrong with eating meat, fish, chicken with moderation. The emphasis is with moderation.
What does that mean?
Twice a week, okay?
I'm a dead man.
You could eat more, but you'd have to experiment, you see. So in other words, you could go for a period of time and say, all right, look, I'm going to eat some form of animal protein 4 days a week.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and stay away from sugar. And so I'm going to get some of my calories from this animal protein. It doesn't have any carbohydrate in it. And then I'm going to try to eat vegetables and legumes that don't have a lot of carbohydrate and fruits that don't have a lot of carbohydrate and see what happens. And over a period of, you know, days to weeks, you're going to look at both your blood sugar and you're going to look at your cholesterol, and then you're going to say, well, you know, what happened to both? I would argue that you're probably going to find, because humans are omnivorous, and you're probably going to find that eating relatively low carbohydrate, that is staying away from refined sugars and fructose and all these things, will keep your blood sugar where it should be, and that eating some animal protein is perfectly fine and is not going to cause you to have, you know, cholesterols through the roof. If you're eating 25 eggs a day, you know, well, some people can do that and get away with it. But most people, if they eat that many eggs, you know, they're going to find that their, you know, cholesterol goes up you know, and mostly on the basis of saturated fat. But there are some individuals who are sensitive to the effects of dietary cholesterol that you'll find in eggs. Most of the elevation in serum cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol that happens with steak and chicken and fish, occurs because of the saturated fat that they contain. So the body, from that saturated fat, will make LDL cholesterol. So if you eat in moderation, you're generally not going to have a problem. It's individuals who, you know, they go out for a steak and they got to have a 16-ounce, you know, sirloin or porterhouse instead of a 3 or 4 ounce filet. Those are individuals that are going to have, and if they do it too often, those are individuals who are going to have problems with their cholesterol on the basis of eating meat. But inherently, meat is not inherently a bad thing, you know, from my perspective, at least not from a cardiovascular perspective. It needs to be eaten with a certain frequency and in certain amounts. I try not to eat more than 3 or 4 ounces of fish, chicken, or you know, red meat at any one sitting.
Okay. So we were talking to Dr. Paul Lemansky, who is both an MD and a guy who has specialized in nutrition, has a master's degree in nutrition all of his life, and has taken huge groups of people and worked with them and worked on their body weight with them, and a guy who I have great respect for. Okay, so let's...
Why don't we talk, Alan, about the success that you've had recently employing what Dr. Fung has talked about. So we talked about low-carbohydrate diets as pulling down blood sugar. And what we intimated and mentioned quickly, that Dr. Fung has also talked about intermittent fasting.
Yeah, now that's where this is going.
Right.
And that's what is extraordinary, just extraordinary. I was waking up in the mornings doing my overnight pinprick on my hands and getting anywhere from, you know, 140, 135, and now below 100.
Right.
Because I have followed your advice, Paul Lemansky. You came on, you told me about Dr. Fung, and you told me about his research and what you've been thinking for years. And it's called intermittent fasting, and perhaps you could explain all of that to us.
Yeah, and I think the bottom line here, remember we originally said that it's insulin resistance that's the problem with type 2 diabetes. What intermittent fasting does is it resets our insulin sensitivity in some way. No one really is quite sure how it works, but it works. And, you know, again, individuals who are diabetic, who are on medications, need to work closely, almost on a daily basis, with a physician to make sure that they both reduce the amount of medications that they're utilizing and insulin that they're utilizing prior to attempting anything like this. So it takes close supervision. We have to work with a dietitian. But it is possible to achieve, for many people, I would say the majority of type 2 diabetics, it is possible to achieve dramatic improvements, not completely by going the weight loss route, although you may find it easier to lose weight with intermittent fasting.
You can say that again.
But the total, we're saying the total weekly calories that you consume are going to be the same, but how you consume them is going to be different. So Dr. Fung talks about, as an example, a 36-hour fast, okay? And not everybody who's going to do this is just going to drink water and then not eat anything. But he's talking about if you're going to do it, you do it for its purest form, you would do 36 hours. So let's say you go to bed at night Monday. You get up at 6 o'clock. You fasted all night, so you got 12 hours under your belt. You then do another, you don't eat that rest of that day and that evening. And then you go to bed at night not eating anything either.
So you've missed a day.
You've missed a day and a night. So 36 hours.
Right.
Okay? And you do that 2 or 3 times a week. The total number of calories that you consume, and again, someone on diabetes medicine shouldn't do this without working with a physician on an intimate basis, but you get improvements, total number of calories the same, improvement in blood sugar, and improvement in the ability to control body weight, okay? So that your body weight starts to go down. And you're like, What's going on?
Is there such a thing as too low? I mean, one of the
too low a body weight?
Yeah. I mean,
of course, there's always you know, the extremes.
There are days. I mean, I was up to 140. Now I'm down, you know, to 122.
Yeah, what I basically, you know, use as a bottom line is, so most individuals are going to be at their optimal weight for height at age 21. So if you remember what you weighed at age 21,
125.
Right. If you go below that, that's a problem. Now, a lot of people, because your body composition changes as you get older, what does that mean? It means that you lose muscle and you replace it with fat. So if you were to try to achieve your age 21 body weight, in your face used to have a lot of muscle, was replaced with fat, so you don't look that much different. But then you lose the fat
sure.
by losing weight, and suddenly people come up to you and you go, are you okay? So how much of that can you take before you go, ah, this is crazy, I'm not going to do this. So you don't. What I tell people is you certainly shouldn't go below what your age 21 body weight was. This is for the average person who is overweight. But
although you could have been a little bit obese when you were
21. You could, yeah. So I'm just saying, the average person.
Yeah.
You could lose up to the point where people are starting to, you want people to tell you you look great, because that's positive reinforcement. And certainly you're going to improve your health by losing weight down to a body mass index of probably around, you know, 23 to 25. We don't think that, you know, losing excess weight is going to be helpful. In fact, it's pretty much a J-shaped curve. You know, you create other problems if you go down too low.
What problems?
Starvation is one.
Oh yeah. Well, not so. Okay, but Paul, you gave us the example of missing basically a day.
Yeah.
Dr. Fong has another thing that he says, and that's intermittent fasting, in which you eat for 8 hours. You're allowed to eat during your 8 hours.
Yes.
And then during the rest of the time, for the next 16 hours, you can't eat.
Right.
So you go to bed at, you have your last meal at 4 in the afternoon.
Yes.
You go to 4, and then you add another 4 hours on that. And so your first meal could be 8 o'clock the next day. That's what I've been doing.
Yeah, and it's called time-limited feeding.
Yeah.
Okay. And interesting. And the simplest way, for people who are not on medication that lowers their blood sugar, the simplest way to start that would be you go 12 hours without eating. So in other words, you have your dinner at night at 6 o'clock, and then you don't eat anything until 6 o'clock in the morning. If that's okay, then you can actually extend that a bit and go 14 hours.
Right.
There is data, Alan, and this is very exciting information. There is data that mortality goes down for individuals who do make that simple change.
Well, I find it very easy, to be honest with you. You started out by saying, tell us about what you did. I did that. I combined two diets. I combined Dr. Fung's diet and something called the Whole30 diet, meaning I was not being stupid. I had a very good friend, a relative, who called me up and said, listen, I'm doing what you told me to do, but I'm not losing any weight. I said, what are you eating? He said, I'm eating a lot in my allowed 8 hours. I said, well, you can't do that.
Yeah, and you know, here's the emphasis that I want to place. This takes some experimentation, okay, because each individual is going to have to determine the mix of because both ketosis or a ketogenic diet or a lower carbohydrate diet and intermittent fasting, both, and we can also add weight loss, will improve insulin sensitivity. How you make this mix up is going to be up to you, both what your preferences are, and also you may find that when you, if you were to, for example, fast, and in the period of time when you were so-called fasting, you're not truly completely fasting, you're just eating extremely low carbohydrate in that time frame, you might find that that's acceptable to you and works well for you.
Except that if you're like me, an all-or-nothing person,
then you have to stay with it. Then you want to find some mix of these ideas that works for you. And again, that's why working with, you know, a lifestyle medicine physician, an individual who is interested in these kind of non-medicated approaches to the treatment of chronic medical problems, is important. Working with a registered dietitian Many of them will help people to implement this kind of thing.
Many of them not know what the hell they're talking about? I mean, to be honest with you, Paul, I've talked to dietitians who say, okay, you have your potatoes on your plate. I'm not going to ever eat a potato again as long as I live.
There are traditionally trained people, and then there are people who are like Dr. Fung who are on the cutting edge of something new. And the way I like to think of this in medicine is there's an inherent inertia to ideas. And so what works or what seems to work or what seems to be accepted by consensus medicine may go on for a period of time until some individual says, well, look, I've been using this with my patients. It just doesn't work. I'm going to try something different. And they try something different, and lo and behold, they open up a whole new area of potential research to see how can we skin the cat a different way and maybe get a better outcome.
Paul, you said in the very beginning of our interview today that there were some things you didn't agree with Dr. Fung on.
Right.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. So, Dr. Fung has made some comment about the consumption of saturated fat. And, from my perspective, a lot of the criticism of nutritional medicine in the last 30 or 40 years came from the eat low-fat diet.
Yeah.
And what happened was people responded by eating high carbohydrate, and that in part fueled the obesity epidemic and the diabetes epidemic as a consequence.
Got it.
So, however, if you really go back and look at what was recommended, it was recommended to eat low fat, it wasn't necessarily recommended to eat high carbohydrate as a consequence of that. Mm. And low fat, really what we mean when we say low fat is low saturated fat. We don't really mean, and certainly I don't mean when I say patients, I want them to reduce fat in the diet, I'm very specific. I want them to reduce saturated fat. And saturated fat is important because saturated fat makes LDL cholesterol. Now,
Which is the bad one.
Yeah. I mean, it's LDL cholesterol, which is in the cholesterol plaques.
So here's a stupid question for everybody out there. I ask it on everybody else's behalf. Give us some examples of saturated fat.
Okay. So butter. Uh-huh. Okay. Cheese mm-hmm. is going to contain large amounts of saturated fat. Marbled meats. Okay. You can look at a piece of meat and you trim the visible fat off. They say trim the visible fat. That visible fat, that white stuff,
yeah,
that's saturated fat.
And saturated in this case means?
If you look at its molecular structure, it's saturated with hydrogen ions. So in other words, there's no double bonds there. It's all single bonds and it's all got a lot of hydrogen. All right. So that's what we're talking about in saturated. It really comes from the biochemistry of the structure of the fat.
And so to keep it short, saturated fat is butter and milk and cheese.
And cheese, yes. And all that good stuff that unfortunately will raise LDL cholesterol. However, and this is where I agree with Dr. Fung, other types of fat are perfectly fine. So I eat an avocado a day.
Sure.
Okay, it's monounsaturated fat. I use olive oil, monounsaturated fat. Now, in nature, looking specifically at olive oil, if you drink enough olive oil, it contains some saturated fat. So if you drink too much of it, you're sort of working across purposes with what you're trying to do, which is to restrict total amount of saturated fat. But you use olive oil because it is inherently low in saturated fat. And that's probably accounts for one of the reasons why it's associated with populations that are relatively healthy in the Mediterranean basin. There are people within the nutritional community that feel that any saturated fat, consumption is a bad idea. I'm not one of them. That said, unnecessary amounts of saturated fat is probably something that should be avoided, and that includes eating, marbled meats in excess.
So you said something that I found fascinating in the beginning. You said, of course, you have to drink water.
Yes.
Why is water so important?
Well, we come from the sea, I guess you might say. We're all fishes. We're all, in order for our biochemical pathways to work properly, we have to stay hydrated. If we become dehydrated, we can do actual damage to our kidneys. And the reason why in a ketogenic diet that I emphasize fluid is because ketosis is inherently a type of a diuretic. So think about it, Alan. If you've got glycogen in your muscle.
Glycogen, of course, once again,
is a large, long, linear molecule which consists of glucose and then a water molecule and a glucose molecule and a water molecule in a long linear array.
Yeah, but it's also, glycogen is what we call, if we lay people label as sugar, right?
It is sugar. It is a complex sugar, but it is still sugar because the body uses a storage form of glucose.
Right. So to put it mildly, if you say you've got too much glycogen in your liver, you're talking about too much sugar in your liver.
Too much sugar in general. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So when you mobilize that glycogen, Let's say you go in ketosis. That is, I'm not eating anything that contains carbohydrate, or I'm actually fasting and just drinking water. What happens is your body mobilizes the glucose to send it to the brain. And where does the water go? So you got a glucose and a water molecule. They're linked together. The glucose goes to the brain. The water molecule goes out. So unless you drink, you have the potential for becoming, dehydrated. Now, it also is true that if you don't drink sufficiently, that if you have, for example, in a ketogenic diet, people in our programs are eating a lot of protein, it tends to increase uric acid in the blood. Okay, so some people are genetically predisposed to elevated uric acid, and they may have gout if they eat too much meat or if they dietary indiscretion. But the average person's uric acid is going to rise if they eat a lot of meat. What you want to do is to make sure that uric acid never crystallizes out in any of your joints because it causes a gouty attack, or in your kidneys, it causes a kidney stone. And the way to do that is to keep your blood as dilute as you can. You should be drinking 64 ounces a day. So there is a limit to what you should be drinking of water, okay? If you drink too much water too quickly, you could actually drive your serum sodium down and have a seizure. There are actually people who have died in trying to show off how much water they can drink.
When I was 15, a friend told me if you drink too much water, you could die.
Yeah.
That's true.
It is true.
But on the other hand, if you drink too little water.
Yes. So what we do is we set an amount so that people have an idea of what the parameters are. Around 64 ounces, eight-ounce glasses of water a day for a person with, normal kidney function should be absolutely
fine.
Well,
that's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot, but it's what you require. Now, of course, if you have heart failure or other things where you've been told by your physician to restrict your fluid intake, it can be a problem. But for the average healthy person, 64 ounces a day allows you to mobilize all the poisons in your system from breakdown, of various toxins and tissue breakdown, to mobilize that and get it out of the body. I mean, urea, all this stuff needs to be gotten rid of. That's why you urinate, and you want to make sure that you can do that in as efficacious a way as possible.
Now, Paul Lemensky, are there chemical tests when you doctors send us for all of those tests? Are there things on your long list of results that come back that would indicate that you're getting too little water?
So we look at something called blood urea nitrogen.
Yeah.
Okay. And if we look at...
It's called BUN.
BUN. And we look at the BUN, and we look at the creatinine, and we look at the ratio of the two, and we'll get an idea. If the BUN starts to rise significantly, that could be an indicator of that we are...
Not drinking enough water.
Not drinking enough water.
Yeah.
And that we're a little dehydrated.
The only one I ever fail at is my BUN, which means that I'm not drinking enough water. I get that now.
Well, you've got something here. What is that?
That's called coffee.
Oh, okay, fine.
And coffee doesn't help us, does it?
Actually, it does. Okay,
well,
it does count.
Thank God for that. Yeah.
It does count. Liquor doesn't count, but,
Yeah.
Coffee counts. Yeah. Tea counts.
Okay, so we've got 11 minutes to go. I want to just remind everybody we're talking to my doctor, my friend, and a board-certified internist with a master's degree in human nutrition who has helped a lot of people, Dr. Paul Lemansky. Okay, so Paul, with that in mind, let's go over some of the rules that Dr. Fung would give us because somebody may have missed this part of it. You've given a terrific explanation of why we're doing what we're doing. But somebody like, okay, stop the baloney. Just tell me what to do. Okay,
no,
now
not,
we're going to tell you what to do.
Not stop the baloney. Stop the sugar.
Stop the sugar.
Okay, so What we're talking about here, and I think what Dr. Fung would say first, is stop sugar. Sugar's poison in the body.
You cannot go into a store on the turnpike or a place and find anything that fits my diet. You can only find things that have sugar in it.
That's not true.
Okay, you can find an apple, right?
You can find an apple. You can find some nuts.
Yeah.
Okay.
But not peanuts.
You can find peanuts.
You can find peanuts, but they have a lot of salt on them, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are other issues, but we were talking specifically about the issue of could we find something that we could eat that wouldn't necessarily elevate our blood sugar, and peanuts wouldn't elevate our blood sugar.
But peanuts are not real nuts. Right?
That's right. They're legumes.
Legumes, right.
Yes.
So therefore, okay, but I find it very hard to go into a store.
It is, because you have to know what you're looking for. You have to search it out, and it's not easy.
You're starving to death. You go into a store and say, the only thing I could have is a Frankfurter without the bun.
Yes, that's sort of a mixed message with that, but it certainly is low in carbohydrate. Okay. Now that said, again, you have to look and see where your major risks lies.
There's a lot of salt in there.
A tremendous amount of salt. There's a lot of cholesterol and saturated fat.
Why is there saturated fat enough in a hot dog?
We don't want to talk about how hot dogs are made. It's very similar to the way laws are made.
Okay.
Or
gotcha.
Used to be made. I don't know that they're doing anything.
Still are. Yeah.
Yeah, really. But
a lot of corruption in them.
Exactly. So because they throw anything in there, Alan. So skin of an animal, for example, could be thrown in there. And the skin of a chicken, for example, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Contains the great majority of the saturated fat in chicken.
So when you eat your chicken, you don't want to have skin.
That's right. You don't. That's exactly correct.
I'm thinking of all the ways I've been killing myself for all these years and fooling myself.
That's right. Think about a chicken breast. You look on a chicken breast and see it's got very little saturated fat in it. Okay, so where's all the saturated fat in chicken? It's in the skin.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say, well, the skin tastes great. Well, it does taste good.
But it's a killer.
Let's put it this way. If you do it in moderation, you can do it fine. If you want to do it, have wings every night with, eat the skin on the wings, and it's going to get into potential problems.
We have 8 minutes left, and I don't want to fool around here. I want to make sure we get it.
Yeah, we wanted to go over
the rules.
The rules.
Go ahead.
So stay away from sugar.
Right.
Okay. Stay away from excess high fructose corn syrup. So we're talking products primarily.
Sure.
Okay. Stay away from refined carbohydrates. Refined carbohydrates are going to be grains,
okay,
which have had the fiber and the germ or the fat removed. So if you're looking at polished rice as opposed to brown rice, is a bit better because it's got more fiber in it. It's got maybe some of the germ in it. If you're looking at wheat, it's going to be stone ground whole wheat. Why? Because that's going to have the germ in it. Okay. Again, fat's going to slow absorption of carbohydrate. It's going to have fiber in it. Fiber's going to slow absorption of carbohydrate. We have to remember here that when the carbohydrate is put in your belly and in your stomach for absorption, we have evidence that individuals whose blood sugar rises in a spike.
Sure.
Are those individuals who are at increased risk for the development of diabetes, as opposed to individuals where the rise is much more gradual.
Sure.
And comes down in a slow fashion as well. So staying away from refined carbohydrates, staying with grains that rice tends to be, if I were eating rice, I would want to eat brown rice. If I'm eating wheat, I'm going to eat whole wheat. Those are kind of choices that one would make when you could.
And particularly if you're a diabetic. Okay, now let's talk about alternative fasting.
Okay.
What are the rules?
Well, first of all, the rule is to work with, if you've never done this before, is to work with someone who, your physician, your primary care physician or a registered dietitian, who knows something about both your health and how to do this in a safe and effective manner. And by that, I mean, let's say you're not even aware that maybe you are pre-diabetic, okay? And you start doing stuff and have an adverse event occur. Your blood sugar, you start getting shaky. You know, you're like, what the heck's going on? I don't understand. You need someone to turn to who can help and say, well, maybe this, we should try to do it this way, that way. There are different approaches that are better tolerated by some folks than others. So working with someone, not just doing it on your own.
So, for example, if you're my doctor, which you are,
yeah.
And I go on this alternative fasting, which I do, and if my numbers come down to the point where, you know, they're too low, you should know about that,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And we should emphasize to your listeners that you check.
I do. I check four times a day.
There you go. So an individual who's willing to check and is willing to communicate those numbers with their supervising physician, those are individuals where, the safety margin is much, much improved.
But you have to know when to get off. For example, if you're on metformin and Actos as medications.
Absolutely.
Those may have to go out the window.
They may have to go out the window. And as I said earlier, you know, I much prefer people, you know, to go off medication and have their blood sugars run a little high than to stay on medication and bottom out. Because bottoming out can be lethal.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, if they go too low, we've had people in this very building who had to go to the hospital because
absolutely.
They bottomed out.
And you could die. So we should, you know, people on insulin, could really end up. So it has to be done under supervision, Alan. That's the first thing.
Okay. You get Dr. Fung's book and you can look at it
and then.
The alternatives and in terms of fasting.
The diabetes code. And look at what he's suggesting. And he's very, very responsible in there. And then you can look around and bring the book to your primary care doctor and ask, or your endocrinologist, and ask them about how could you accomplish this in a safe and effective way.
Now, how many of these guys are tied into the industry, you know, the drug industry and others? But, you know, do we worry that too many doctors are unwilling to try something new?
Well, you know, this is why I suggest, you know, your endocrinologist is if you're a diabetic, is of course, I think, the best person to talk to about this. They're going to be aware of what's out in the literature and that this type of an approach has been used. They're also going to be aware of what you're taking and where you could end up, you know, getting into trouble and how this type of approach should be implemented.
Right.
You know, I think the first step is for individuals to read about this and or to listen to Dr. Fung on YouTube and then to get an interest that maybe this is something they'd be willing to try. It is not necessarily easy to try something new, okay? Right. And you have to want to improve in order to choose any means by which to do so. So if you have the motivation and then you have background information, then you go to the people who normally take care of you for these problems, your endocrinologist, primary care doctor, and outline a very, very specific plan and a very specific follow-up and ongoing monitoring and communication. And if you put that all together, then you're talking about a situation where the safety factor is sufficient to where, you know, something like this can be tried.
Well, Dr. Paul Lemansky, my doctor, is a nutritionist as well as a board-certified internist, a guy who has helped many people. Paul, I can't thank you enough on behalf of all of our listeners for coming in and doing this. And I want to tell everybody that Paul Lemansky was the director of the Center for Preventive Medicine and as clinical chief for cardiovascular health at Kaiser Permanente Northeast Division. He's an assistant clinical professor of medicine at Albany Medical College and is fellow of the American College of Physicians. And Paul, we thank you so much for doing with this. And I can say that I have been following this, and I am delighted with what my numbers are. They're not there yet, but I have a feeling we're going where we have to go. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.